The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to interview the late Dr. Suhail Bushrooi on a number of occasions. He was always a wonderful man to interview. And back in 2001, I had him on the program to talk about a book called Khalil Gibran, A Spiritual Treasury. And the beautiful thing about talking to Dr. Bushrooi was that you never knew where the conversation might go. You never knew what kinds of things he might talk about. And in this conversation, he talked about a number of things, including the fact that he was one of the only people to ever interview the playwright Samuel Beckett. Let's listen now to Dr. Suhail Bushrooi, who died just a year or two ago, from the Best of the Book Nook, recorded back in 2001, talking about Khalil Gibran, A Spiritual Treasury.
My guest is Suhail Bushrooi, and one thing that comes through in your work and in listening to you speak and in the works of others who you've cited, Gibran, Yeats, Blake, the life of the soul, we illustrate it with language, with words, with poetry, with spirit.
Absolutely.
And in our modern age, we see a removal of a lot of that feeling. We see that with the death of T.S. Eliot, we have no great poets. As you mentioned, in would you call this a monograph?
Yeah, it's a monograph. Yes.
It's called A Defense of Poetry. Yeah. I very much enjoyed this.
Yeah. You know, as I said in that short work, I met Samuel Beckett in 1987. And Beckett is a remarkable man. I became very close to him, really, in his final years. And he was never close to anybody, as you very well know. As a matter of fact, he never gave interviews. And I believe I was one of the very, very few, one out of two or three people in the world who had an interview with him. But it was the time when Lebanon was in very difficult situation. It was really, you know, I was in Lebanon in the 80s and things were so bad. It was there that I realized that Dante's vision of hell was not something relegated to the literary books. It was a reality, and I saw it in Lebanon, really. And the humanity of Beckett, and people who read him, they think, well, here is somebody who does not believe in God, that he does not believe in anything. He is so cold, so cynical, so down to earth. Well, people don't read Beckett correctly, you see. And when I mentioned to him, I said, you know, Western scholars look at your work and they find a different lesson than I do in Waiting for Godot. They think that, well, God is lost, is gone. It's almost as you were trying to repeat Nietzsche's statement, God is dead. But of course, if you continue the statement of Nietzsche, you find out that he said, of course, we killed him. God is not dead. We killed him in our hearts. What you're saying is that it's not really up. It's not for us to wait for God to come to us. We have to go to him. And, you know, he turned around, he smiled as though he understood exactly what I was trying to say. He said, you know, you may have a point there. So he didn't reject me out of hand, and he would have done. But there is also, literature has this great literature. It's like anything that can be used in this world, which is of value to us, we can either use it to destroy or to build. And I think, unfortunately, in the last, 105, since the Enlightenment, we have allowed the intellect to tyrannize our existence. At the expense of what? Of the inner strength, of those values of the spirit. And we try to impose on the spirit, you see, materialistic logic. Well, how can you? Things that are extremely difficult to define or to see under a microscope or to analyze through a graph. How on earth can you impose materialistic logic on the things? Well, in Shakespeare, you know, Hamlet's marvelous words to those people who did not believe the visions he saw, which were real to him. And he said to Horatio, the logician, the philosopher, the man down to earth, he said to him, "Oh, there are more things on earth and heaven than is dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio." Well, there is a mystery in this world. Einstein did not deny it either. He said, if you believe in mystery, you're religious. And in this sense, I'm the most religious of men. Unfortunately, we have also, imposed on religion a certain restriction, which is materialistic logic. It must make sense. Well, there are a lot of things in this world that are a mystery. Why do you want to destroy the mystery?
And why do we all need to be the same?
Exactly.
In this period of the word that they like to bandy about is globalization.
Yeah.
Why do we all want to be the same? Why can't we celebrate our differences?
Quite right. I think the key word here would be unity in diversity, really. And it is this principle that Gibran took up and understood fully. He took this up. He met a man who came from the East who had a great message, a modern message of love and world unity, called Abdu'l-Bahá. He met him in New York in 1911, 1912, and he heard this term, unity in diversity. This, indeed, allowed him to develop this vision. So you see, I mean, when he looks at anything, it is, nothing in this. Blake said it too. Everything that lives is holy. And Gibran believed this. The Sufis believed that. I think if you were a true believer, following any spiritual tradition in this world, the one great statement you can make, yes, I accept all that exists as being the creation of my beloved Creator. And as such, I love what I see around me. This is the measure of truth, really. If you talk to me in any other language, which does not include your love and acceptance and respect for every human being, because, what does the Bible tell us? That man is the temple, the sacred temple of God. Your body is a sacred temple of God. What does this mean? In you reside a spirit that is sacred and divine. How on earth can I show you anything but respect and honor? Even if you were a murderer, I can't do that. There is something about you as a human being.
My guest is Dr. Suhail Bushrooi, and we've been discussing his latest work, Khalil Gibran, A Spiritual Treasury, compiled by Suhail, and also a short piece here called A Defense of Poetry. And for those of our listeners who haven't heard you on previous programs, tell us what you do.
Of course, my main passion now is to help the young people in America to develop an inner strength, to strengthen those spiritual qualities and values that will allow them to face the challenges that I think the young people of today face, and no other generation has faced what they face. I am a teacher, and I hope I deserve this title. I'm not an instructor. I do not go into the classroom and pour out information for people to memorize and give me back in an exam. My main task is to excite the mind, to allow an education, to educate the mind. It is true. But this is not my sole purpose. Because what is the use of educating the mind when you completely ignore the heart? So part of my duties in educating the mind is a simultaneous process of educating the heart. And that comes through how I conduct my class, how I relate to my students, you see, how they relate to me. My classes are experiential as well as intellectual and academic. And the result is that when I follow the career of my students, I see how beneficial. I have students who come back to me and they say, look, it was you who gave me something very valuable. I cannot explain it. I say, well, as long as you can't, it means it was valuable. There are certain things we can't explain. Now, I'm a teacher, as I said, but also I live in this world, and I live in a world that today, more than anything else, needs peace. Peace not only when I speak about universal peace, political peace. On the contrary, we need economic peace. We need peace that will descend upon every individual, really. The peace within oneself. So I try as much as possible in my own way with, and I usually deal with small classes because you can't really do much. You know, we quarrel about how much money we're going to pour into education. And I wonder that here in this country, the greatest and the most important country in the world, there's no doubt about that. But we must not be complacent. And we cannot rely on what we have achieved so far. I think the greatest danger facing America today, I think this danger is the greatest of all the dangers. It is not nuclear holocaust. It's not an enemy from outside. It is from within, really. It is the role that big money in this country plays. You know, I think my listeners know that. They understand what I'm saying. Once you begin to look at your profit and say, all right, what do I do to please my shareholders? You'll do anything. And therefore, the ethical, the value system, the human element, everything will be sacrificed for that. This is nothing new. This has been always the case. That's why poetry, as you know, was one of the great forces that faced the tyranny of wealth. Now, in the past, it was one or two or three or a class. Today, whether we like it or not, it's the corporations. Who are the target of the corporations today? Young people. The marketability of something, you know, right? The profit graph that must rise. How do we do to really make this popular?
Consuming from the cradle.
Exactly. And I think this is, I have no political allegiance. I'm an immigrant who came to this country, took up the nationality. I love America. I serve America. I couldn't care less whether you are a Republican, whether you're a Democrat, whether you are this or that. I couldn't care less what religion you follow. I couldn't care less what orientation you have. All I'm interested in, how honest and true and valuable a citizen you are, in which you understand that you cannot maintain the integrity of this nation if you do away with all the values that it has embedded in its own constitution, in its Declaration of Independence, in everything that the great Americans of this, you know, these are the people we never hear about. We hear about, whom do we hear about? Singers? Entertainers? You know, film stars? And Emerson? And Thoreau? And Frost? And Longfellow? And the great thinkers that were in the world and brought about this prosperity, this great society into being. So really, I believe that the greatest, and Gibran was equally. You see, this is again warning over and over again the pernicious, destructive influence of big money. And that's why I say that, I told you, I have no political interest whatsoever, but I think that the message of Senator McCain was very much in order, in its place. This man had been to Vietnam, he had suffered, he had been wounded, and he has seen misery and unhappiness. And I think he was honest in what he said. But unless the people of the United States, you see, understand this, before it is too late, we're going to pay a very heavy price.
I often wonder if those small voices out in the wilderness are heard, and through the beauty of radio, we can bring some of these voices to our listeners here in Southwest Ohio. I've had Harold Bloom on the program a couple
really?
Of times.
Oh, really? Wonderful, yes.
In the last year and a half. And I know you probably agree on a lot of points when it comes to literature, but I think you probably disagree on a lot of points as well. But it's so great to talk about language, to share words, to share thoughts, ideas, opinions, whether you agree or disagree with someone.
Of course, of course, of course. Oh, well, after all, you know, it's very important that no matter how much you disagree with someone, you should not be disagreeable towards someone. And, you know, if you really speak the language of love, how can you hate, really? So people disagree, of course they do. But what is very important, that we have to come to learn, both of us who have this idea or that, to work together. That's why, you know, we were going to talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and I said the missing dimension in this conflict, Vic, the missing dimension. Can you believe this? I mean, I am astounded. In a situation where the religious and cultural, you see, dimensions are so enormous, the only people who are negotiating are politicians and economists. This other group is non-existent, and therefore it could be used by any. And, you know, I wrote a piece on this called The Missing Dimension. Where are the people who represent culture and religion from both sides in the process of negotiation? Somebody said to me, he said, you know, all these religions are so divided. I said, the politicians are united? The economists are united? Oh, come on, don't give me this nonsense. Everybody is divided. But if you do not provide the forum in which these people come and talk, you know, and I give you an example. One of the greatest periods in the history of the world was Spain during the reign of Abdurrahman II, about the 10th century, 11th century AD. All right. Abdurrahman II, what did he do? He brought the Jewish rabbis, and the Muslim religious leaders put them in a conference together. Said, look here, I want to build up a society in which everybody is accepted, everybody can work together. What did they do? They set ideologies aside and they began to work together. The result was, do you know what the result of that society was? The Renaissance in Europe. It was the Jewish people in Spain who translated all that the Arabs translated from Greek into Hebrew, from Hebrew into Latin. The cooperation, they were teaching in the universities, they were doctors, they were judges. For a brief period of time, Christians, Muslims, and Jews were building a society that brought about the Renaissance in Europe.
Would these be the Sephardic Jews?
Yeah, well, they were, no, not necessarily, but some of course were. Of course, there were great figures. Mm-hmm. Even in Arabic literature today, if you look at these names, I mean, and they have influenced a lot Arab culture and civilization, in the same way that there was an influence from the Sufi tradition into. So really, it can work. Mm-hmm. But what is so sad is that we've become so, you know, I always say, right, we denounce fanaticism, right? Of course, we hate fanatics. Oh, these are fanatics. Now, I think we have developed another kind of fanaticism in academia. It is intellectual fanaticism. What difference is there between somebody who says, no, I don't want to hear these people, they are all out. They can't do any good. It's the same thing as this, as the other side who says, I don't want to do anything with these people, they are out, they're no good. On the contrary, dialogue, you see, dialogue.
You make the point that Gibran was on to something. One of our big buzzwords these days is conflict resolution.
Exactly.
How are they ever going to resolve that conflict over there in the Middle East? Do we need some stronger leadership? Where is it going to come from?
Well, of course, there are the details of the situation. And, you know, when they talk about this or that, these are all minor, really, in fact. They seem major because, now, what was needed in this situation that was not done? What was needed was an educational program, a campaign of really going out to these two people, the Arabs and the Jews, by both sides, and reminding them, first of all, of the shared heritage that they have. You see, this is one family. let's shed all our nationalities and race and ethnicity and all that, and let's look at it in, what's it, truthfully before the throne of God. Abraham was the physical and the spiritual father of both Jews and Arabs. Isaac and Ishmael, and really, whether Abraham was sacrificing Isaac or Ishmael is neither here nor there. You know, there's such a quarrel over this issue, and the story really is not about Isaac or Ishmael, it's about Abraham. He was being tested. Mm-hmm. But people forget this, and you see how differences and quarrels start in time. And God, when he asked Abraham to sacrifice, well, according to Islamic tradition, Ishmael, who's the great-grandfather of the Arabs, or Isaac, which is the great-grandfather of the Jews. It's neither here nor there. You see, it was Abraham being tested. It was the grandfather of all of us, really, our father. Now, the most holy spot of Islam, a Kaaba, to which Muslims from every corner of the earth travel to perform their duty of pilgrimage. This is the house of Abraham. I am not saying this. It's in the Quran. It is revealed you see, through the tongue of glory, God's own words, Baytu Ibrahim, it is the house of Abraham. Right. Then, when you read the most holy book, the Quran, which Muslims believe is direct revelation of God through Gabriel to Muhammad, you see, well, what are the figures that are the role models? Jacob? David? Moses? Abraham? You notice anything with these names?
They sound familiar, don't they?
Yeah, you see? So the shared heritage is so immense. And then the two religions were in their origins desert religions. You know, both the tribes. Jews were tribes, Arabs were tribes, nomadic people, you see, desert people. So they're so similar, really, really. The Ten Commandments are repeated word for word in the Quran as they were accepted by Christianity, which again should convince us all there is a golden thread that runs through all of these, you see. Gibran believed in the unity of religion. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
I think that one of he speaks about, of course, God, and he speaks about religion, but and even when he comes to speak about Christ, Christ becomes a symbol not only of the Christ of Christianity, becomes a symbol of every truth that has been revealed unto the world, you see. When Gibran says, all souls will be in God. When the soul reaches God, it will be conscious that it is in God and that it is seeking more of itself in being in God, and that God too is growing and seeking and crystallizing. In other words, there was never a difference. And I think that when we, those of us who believe in an afterlife, if we are asked, then we are not going to be asked, what religion do you belong to? Right, you know, this is a race, right, religion, right? This is what we do here. There we'd say, please, pray, tell us, what have you done? How many people have you helped when they needed you? How many broken hearts have you mended? You see? How many hungry mouths have you fed? Your brother suffering, your sister suffering. Did you really go out of your way to help? That are the questions that you'll be going to be asked, my friend. They're not going to ask you, did you go to church on Sunday? Did you go to synagogue on Saturday? Did you go to mosque on Friday? I don't think so.
Did you buy Microsoft?
Exactly. Quite right. Quite right. Quite right.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Building a More Informed Community with Independent News and Storytelling. And that was the late Dr. Suhail Bushrooi. Recorded back in 2001, he made a number of appearances on the program over the years, and he died just a year or two ago. Khalil Gibran, A Spiritual Treasury, was the book he had out. He was a prolific writer and an amazing man, and I was happy to be able to bring you that excerpt from The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Go to our website to hear hundreds of podcasts at wyso.org.